Iran reiterates that the U.S. is to blame for the JCPOA status quo, censuring some signatories' silence on Washington's excessive demands. The UN calls for talks on Hodeidah as the Saudi-backed militants have withdrawn from around the Yemeni port city despite the kingdom's intensified attacks. Also ahead, Israeli forces raise several shops of Palestinians near the Qalandia checkpoint north of occupied Al-Quds. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: Iran says there's consensus among the participants of the 2015 nuclear deal that the U.S. is to blame for the current state of the accord. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remark in a phone call with his Italian counterpart Luigi Di Maio. Iran's top diplomat noted that some of the participants to the deal have acted irresponsibly by staying silent in the face of the U.S.'s excessive demands. He said their inaction led to the current situation. Di Maio, for his part, expressed hope that the upcoming Vienna talks will end in the intended results and help Tehran and Rome boost their bilateral ties. Earlier, we were joined by political commentator Richard Becker, who gave us his thoughts on the Iran nuclear deal and the developments since the U.S. withdrawal from the accord.
After Trump withdrew from the JCPOA, announced the unilateral and I believe illegal withdrawal from what was essentially a treaty, the partners of the United States who were part of it and members of the Security Council, meaning, of course, Britain and France and also Germany, which is not in the Security Council, but one of the negotiating partners in this, that they all said to Iran, no, no, stay in the agreement. We'll find ways to overcome the problems that you now face because the U.S. has pulled out. And it didn't happen. It didn't happen in any kind of a significant way at all. So the deafening silence, I think, is the correct way to put what the allies of the United States, how they have reacted to the United States' unilateral withdrawal from the treaty. I think the Iranian government has gone out of its way to maintain adherence to the agreement. And we had Biden, when he was running for president, indicating that he would restore the U.S. to the deal, but never intended to do that without exacting more sanctions, which the Iranian government understandably is not willing to do.
A United Nations monitoring mission in Yemen has called on the warring sides to hold new talks over the western port city of Hodeidah. The mission said the withdrawal of Saudi-backed forces from the areas near the strategic city and the Yemeni army's advancement there marks a shift on the front lines. It's added that the developments warrant fresh discussions between the two sides. The call came a day after Saudi warplanes targeted an area east of the city of Hayz in Hodeidah province, killing 3 civilians and injuring 7 others. That's despite a UN-backed truce reached in 2018 that called for the cessation of fighting along the Hodeidah front. The Ansarullah movement has said it expects the deal to lead to peace, but instead, Saudi Arabia has continued to violate the ceasefire, killing and injuring thousands of Yemenis ever since. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization has voiced concern about the dire humanitarian situation in Yemen, warning that 75% of children there suffer from acute malnutrition. The WHO also said that over 16 million Yemenis are facing food insecurity. That's almost half of the country's total population. Previously, the UN Security Council warned about the increasing risk of severe famine in Yemen, exacerbated by the poor economic situation. Yemen has been mired in crisis since a Saudi-led coalition launched a devastating war on the country in 2015. Around 80% of the country's population is now in need of humanitarian assistance. Israeli forces have demolished Palestinian shops near the Qalandia checkpoint north of occupied Al-Quds. Israeli bulldozers backed by the regime's troops razed three shops. Israel has a long history of tearing down Palestinian homes and structures under different pretexts, including a lack of construction permit. Tel Aviv pushes ahead with its demolition drive despite international criticism. A month ago, Israeli authorities wrecked all structures in the village of Araqib. Palestinians say the move is part of the regime's land grab policy to expand its illegal settlements. A UN report shows Israel's confiscation that is of Palestinian homes in Al-Quds and the West Bank has increased by 21% in 2021 compared to last year. Israel's top court has dismissed an appeal for the immediate release of a hunger-striking Palestinian prisoner who is at imminent risk of death. This is the fourth time the Israeli Supreme Court has rejected a petition submitted for the release of Qaid al-Fasfus. A Palestinian commission for prisoners says the rejection shows the Israeli officials' indifference and deliberate criminal disregard for the life of the inmate. 34-year-old Al-Fasfus has been on hunger strike for 125 days in protest at his indefinite detention without charge or trial. Four other Palestinians are also refusing food for months over their so-called administrative detention. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has expressed support for the detainees and called for urgent international action to save their lives. Earlier we discussed about Israel's much criticized administrative detention policy with human rights activist Bruce Katz. He explains how such practices can only be employed by totalitarian and apartheid regimes.
Basically, what it points to is simply the disregard for Palestinians as human beings. The question of Palestinian prisoners is at the very crux of the battle against apartheid. It should be remembered, these are the vast majority of Palestinians in the Israeli carceral system are political prisoners. And when we talk about administrative detention, it should be remembered that administrative detention is something that can be repeated every 6 months. Palestinians are simply taken off the street. There are no formal charges. There is no proof. There's no due process. The only places you can have things such a system of arbitrary incarceration is in a totalitarian state. And that is essentially what Israel is. As for the ruling of the Supreme Court, let us remember that this is the Supreme Court of an apartheid state, and the function of that Supreme Court is to lend a legal, or rather a pseudo-legal, legitimacy to criminal actions on the part of the apartheid regime in Tel Aviv that runs that state.
The European Union has decided to impose fresh sanctions against Belarus amid deepening tensions with Minsk over a migrant crisis. The decision was made during a meeting of EU foreign ministers in Brussels, where they agreed to amend the 2020 sanctions against Belarus. Before the meeting, one of the ministers accused Minsk of violating human rights, saying severe economic sanctions against it is inevitable. Turning to other news now, the UK government has raised the country's terror alert level from substantial to severe following a car explosion in the northwest city of Liverpool in the weekend. The announcement came after police declared the fatal explosion a terror incident. Saeed Poreza reports from Liverpool.
A weekend terror incident in Liverpool, UK. One man killed, one injured, and four aged between 20 and 29 arrested under the controversial counter-terrorism law. The mood among some, one of shock and disbelief.
Honestly, shock. You know, I couldn't believe it. I've never been around anything like this in my life. I moved up here just for uni, so to have something happen like this, you know, right next to my accommodation is very scary.
Police say the passenger, 32-year-old Imad Al-Suwaylmin, carried a homemade explosive device into the taxi. The driver, David Perry, locked the suspect in the car to prevent a worse situation, escaped with minor injuries. The timing has had everyone thinking. Just 2 minutes before Remembrance Sunday, when the entire country remembers Britons killed in wars. In Monday, the government raised the terror threat level from substantial to severe, warning residents to be vigilant.
The police have now confirmed that this is being treated as a terrorist attack, and while the investigation continues at pace, you will understand that I can't comment on the details of the case or its motivation, but it is a stark reminder of the need for us all to remain utterly vigilant.
There are still three police cordons in the city, one here at the Women's Hospital, the site of the explosion, and the two major streets elsewhere. Police are still investigating to establish the circumstances of what happened. Police are still searching two addresses for more clues into the motivation behind the incident. Saeed Poreza, Liverpool.
Elsewhere, Russia has described as provocative the recent military drills by the U.S. and its NATO allies in the Black Sea, warning that the exercises have increased tensions between Moscow and NATO. President Vladimir Putin made the remark in a phone call with his French counterpart, Emmanuel Macron. They also raised the issue of Ukraine and expressed their dissatisfaction, with Putin calling the situation there worsening. Russia and the West are at loggerheads over a host of issues, including the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Earlier, Washington raised the alarm over alleged Russian military activities near Ukraine's border, but Russia has denied the accusations of fueling unrest in the neighboring country. Israeli organizations and military sites have been targeted by major cyber attacks over the past months. A hacking group called Moses Staff now says it has acquired sensitive information on the location and characteristics of Israel's vital systems across the occupied Palestinian territories.
Israel has always touted its intelligence agency as invulnerable, but a spate of recent hacking attacks against the regime has undermined the narrative. A hacking group, which calls itself Moses' Staff, has released a video saying it has successfully carried out a massive cyber attack on Israel and broken into the servers of its major companies. The group says it is now in possession of comprehensive data, which include information on the location and properties of the regime's sensitive and vital systems across the occupied Palestinian territories. The data also includes airborne mapping surveys with 5-centimeter accuracy and three-dimensional images of Israeli military sites. Moses' Staff is the third group of its kind that has exclusively hacked Israeli organizations and released confidential information of high-ranking military officials in cyberspace in recent months. Such cyber attacks have exposed the weakness of Israel's spying apparatus. But such incidents are just the tip of the iceberg. In September, six Palestinian inmates escaped from one of Israel's highest security jails, which was described by Palestinian resistance groups as a major intelligence failure. Following Israel's 11-day war on Gaza in May, the regime's intelligence and spying fiasco also made headlines. This was due to severe blows the regime received after Palestinians fired thousands of rockets into Israel. At that time, Palestinian media said the Israeli spying services could not predict Hamas and Islamic Jihad movement's tactics to beat the regime's most wanted Iron Dome system. Israeli media also called for a purge of the regime's military leaders for their role in the failed war on Gaza. Such failures come amid internal divisions inside Mossad. Recently, three senior Mossad officials stepped down over what was cited as organizational changes by the agency's new chief, David Barnea. However, Israeli media have described their resignations as an earthquake. Such a description has highlighted major setbacks Mossad has suffered not only in field operations but also in cyberspace. The blows that Israel has received have further shattered the image of its invulnerability.
Iran's special envoy for Afghanistan is visiting the country for talks with the Taliban government on mutual and regional issues. The envoy, leading a high-ranking delegation, is expected to discuss a wide range of issues, including the formation of an inclusive government. Rahmatullah Baghban has more in this report.
Iran's envoy for Afghanistan, Hassan Kazemi Qomi, has arrived in Kabul for talks on mutual and regional issues. This is the first time that a high-ranking Iranian delegation is visiting Afghanistan since the takeover of the country by the Taliban in August. In an address to reporters upon his arrival in Kabul airport, the Iranian envoy said he would meet senior Taliban officials, adding that security and economic issues would top the agenda. He stressed that two neighboring countries need to expand their ties in all areas.
Afghanistan has been destroyed by invaders over the past decades. Now it's time to rebuild the country. We will help our Afghan brothers rebuild their country. A secure Afghanistan can contribute to regional stability. Afghanistan and Iran should have safe borders and expand their economic ties amid U.S. sanctions. We also need to cooperate in the fight against terrorism, as our enemies are conducting proxy wars after their repeated defeats in the region.
On the other hand, the Taliban have voiced their interest in the expansion of ties with Iran. They vow to continue their talks with the aim of increasing mutual cooperation.
Iran's move to send its special envoy means that the country is seeking to establish normal relations with us and increase the level of cooperation between the two sides. We have many things in common, particularly when it comes to border security and economic exchanges, so we have to continue our talks.
Tehran has stressed the necessity to establish an inclusive government in Afghanistan, representing all sections of Afghan society. Iran has repeatedly condemned any form of terrorism in Afghanistan and expressed its deep concerns over the fate of Afghan civilians, particularly following the recent terrorist attacks which left hundreds of Shia Afghans dead or wounded. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Darfur brings an end to our bulletin for this hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In the United States, employers are still struggling to fill millions of open jobs and to hold on to the workers they already have. More than 4.4 million workers quit their jobs voluntarily in the month of September, the U.S. Labor Department said on Friday, 12th of November 2021. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Ben Castleman. He writes about economics with a particular focus on employment. The piece is titled Millions Quit Jobs in US in September. In the United States, employers are still struggling to fill millions of open jobs and to hold on to the workers they already have. More than 4.4 million workers quit their jobs voluntarily in September of 2021, the U.S. Labor Department said on Friday, 12th of November. That was up from 4.3 million in the month of August and was the most in the two decades that the U.S. government has been keeping track. Nearly a million people quit their jobs in the leisure and hospitality industry alone, reflecting the steep competition for workers there as businesses recover from last year's pandemic-induced shutdowns. There were 10.4 million job openings in the United States at the end of September. That is down a bit from the record 11.1 million posted in July, before the spread of the Delta variant of the coronavirus led to a slump in sales in some businesses. But demand for labor remains extraordinarily high by historical standards. Before the pandemic, the record for job openings in a month was 7.6 million in November of 2018. The U.S. Labor Department revised its estimate for job openings in the month of August to 10.6 million. There were roughly 75 unemployed workers for every 100 job openings in September, the lowest ratio on record. Separate data released last week by the Labor Department showed that job growth rebounded in the month of October, but that the labor force barely grew. You're essentially seeing demand continuing to increase without an offsetting increase in talent, said Ryan Sutton, a district director for Robert Half International, a staffing firm. Until some new talent comes in, until we get employees who are on the sidelines back into the market, it's very likely this is going to continue. Economists cite a number of reasons for the slow return. The pandemic is still disrupting childcare, making it hard for some parents to work. Other workers are worried about contracting the virus or spreading it to high-risk family members. Many Americans have also built up their savings during the pandemic, allowing them to be choosier about their jobs. Those factors are likely to ease as the pandemic ebbs and savings dwindle, but other shifts could prove more lasting. In a research note published on Friday, 12th of November, economists at Goldman Sachs observed that roughly two-thirds of the people who had left the labor force during the pandemic were over 55. Many of them have retired and are unlikely to go back to work. The labor crunch is giving workers the upper hand in negotiations. Wages have risen sharply in recent months, particularly in service jobs, although in other industries, pay is lagging behind the pace of inflation. The recent rise in the number of workers quitting suggests that many are taking advantage of their leverage to accept better-paying jobs, or to look for them. At the same time, understaffing in many businesses may be putting stress on remaining workers, leading even more people to leave their jobs. Industries that require most employees to work in person, such as manufacturing, retail, and the healthcare sector, as well as leisure and hospitality industries, report the biggest increases in the rate of workers leaving their jobs. We are seeing big pickups in quits in the industries that are having the hardest time hiring right now, said Nick Bunker, Director of Economic Research for the job site Indeed. Kaylee Sweeting worked in a restaurant in Millburn, New Jersey, through most of the pandemic, despite concerns about interacting with unmasked customers and frustration about low wages. But when the restaurant pressured a colleague to come to work sick this summer, Katie Sweeting quit her job. "The job was absolutely no longer worth it," she said. "I was hurt that a company that I gave my time to did not seem to prioritize me or my safety." So Ms. Sweeting, a 23-year-old, and her partner, a cook, decided to take the money that they had saved to buy a house and open their own vegan restaurant instead. They recently signed a lease and are beginning renovations with plans to open up early next year. They are trying to apply the lessons they have learned as employees, promising good wages, paid time off, and other basic benefits that restaurant jobs have often failed to provide. "I genuinely love the industry," Katie Sweeting said. "I just don't love the way it's managed. I feel like the only way to change it is to implement the change yourself."
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Brother Ali and Sayyid Abdullah Musa. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So this series of the program Viewpoints is mainly concerned with an analysis on the important points addressed by the leader of the Muslim Ummah, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. In this new series, we are concerned with the topic humans or human beings in the speeches of the leader of Islamic Republic of Iran. So we believe the principles of Western humanities originate from the materialistic thought and... You know, this has been clear to anybody who has read the history of Renaissance and anybody who has become familiar with the people of that era. So when the Renaissance becomes the source of different transformation in the West, then the role of the people and more the materialistic, this mundane life comes to the pin. And it has affected all the arenas of the Islamic humanities like psychology, sociology, philosophy, communication studies, and all that. And based on that, there comes this secular system. So now, from the other side, we have this the role that the human and the human beings and the position that the human beings has in Islam. You know, on different occasions, in the verses of the Quran and the Hadith, it is the direct reference of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you know, Prophet Muhammad and the infallible Imams, you know, here and there referred to the role that the human in humanities has. So can we have any Islamic humanity, Sayyid Abdullah, or not? The case is that, so in this way, we need to develop our own theory, Sayyid Abdullah, isn't it?
The theories
are over there, we have to apply them.
See, when we look at humanity studies or humanitarian studies from a Western perspective, an Islamic perspective, there's one major difference here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if me and you, we have to give a theory. It has to be based on Islam or what pleases Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
Now, so, for example, if we look at psychology, if we look at philosophy, we have to revolve around God and religion,
yes,
right? And from their perspective, not from my perspective. When you look at the Western or the secular humanities, it is from their own perspective. So each philosopher that comes, each psychologist that comes, each therapist that comes, he gets his own definition. For example, look at Freud.
Mm-hmm.
Freud says the sexual tendencies in a child, he has sexual tendencies towards his mother.
Yes.
Now that's Freud's theory.
Yes.
Now this is not based on God. This is not based on logic. It's based on him.
Yes.
And it became a study, and all the rubbish that he came up with,
yes,
it became a study. It's been taught in universities.
Yes.
Darwin's theories, yes, they became a
also
study.
They have been criticized, so, brother, by the Western world too, isn't it? I mean, because in the neo-Darwinism or the Freud ones, you know, there have been so many.
No, so some reviews of them being discussed, but yes, I'm saying that even those which they mm-hmm. accept, whatever yes. theories or philosophers, you know, modern philosophers or back day philosophers, mm-hmm. whatever theories they brought, it was their own from their own creation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not based on God. Yes. It's not based on Islam or yes. What Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants.
Yes.
So they would always get it wrong. And even if they get it right, mm-hmm. it's just their own opinion. Yes. Where if you look at Islam as a system, even as a philosopher, for example, or as a theologist, or what
as
you
a hakim,
might be,
yes.
it still has to be stemmed and has to go through the guidelines of the rules of Allah subhanahu
yes.
wa ta'ala,
yes.
which makes a difference in giving you the results or giving you the answers.
Yes. And you know, during when you look at the history of Islam and all these scholars in different fields of studies, you know, Ibn al-Haytham, for example, you know, al-Khwarizmi, you know, mathematics, you know, Avicenna, Averroes, you know, Ibn al-Rushd, Ibn Sina, you know, Ibn Sina, you know, all these scholars from different fields of science had one foot in the religion and religious mm-hmm. studies, so maybe helping them not to be deviated from the right path. And really brilliant discoveries have been made by them.
So
in the history of Islam,
it, by
yeah.
the way. So
yeah.
Imam Sadiq alayhi salam,
yeah.
for example, he used to have 4,000 students in his,
yeah, yeah.
his majlis, in his lessons, the classes. And Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, not only did he teach Islamic studies or tafsir or exegesis,
yeah.
he actually taught physics, chemistry,
yeah.
He taught even pharmacy, he
yes.
taught sciences of the body,
yes.
he even taught what we call extraction and
yes.
excavation,
yes.
he astronomy.
Yes.
He taught so many sciences that
That's
are...
Right.
If we look at them, they're just
yeah.
human things for
yeah.
the human needs.
So all in all,
yeah.
the difference between the roots of these knowledges actually are have a drastic difference, and the difference is on their worldview. The Islamic one stems from an Islamic worldview.
Mm-hmm.
So in Islamic worldview, as I said, the uniqueness of God is looked at.
Yes.
I mean, it was paid attention to.
Yes.
And also two aspects of
okay.
Human being, that is material
mm-hmm.
aspect and also spiritual aspect of it, is looked at and valued.
Yes.
Also, wisdom is behind everything. We consider wisdom and hikmah behind every action of God in this universe.
Yes.
But in the other, there is no role given to there is no role given to God and the Creator. Then also only one aspect of human being, that is materialistic aspect of him, is being
That's right.
looked at, and they look at the whole actual universe as something, as an accident, or let's say a chance, which we believe that no, there is no chance, and everything here in
okay.
this universe is based on hikmah issued by God.
So you have to manage your, we can say, wisdom, time, and energy on both sides, divinity and the materialistic one. But the question comes up this way, that in the Western world, they have focused on the mundane, materialistic, bodily, physical one, and they have been successful somehow in answering this part of the human beings. But from the other side, you spend your energy and effort and mindset on both of them.
Mm-hmm.
You were not successful in either of them.
So what
could
is
it
the,
be a nice...
Yeah, what is the criteria of this success?
At least answering some of the bodily, for example, needs or managing, the distribution of the world.
If this is the case, I mean, even in the ancient time, the people were more successful and even more knowledgeable, and they actually solved lots of even more difficult questions. Like, as I mentioned earlier in this series of, in one of the shows, so we have seen and witnessed, and it has been proved that corneal transplant has been actually practiced 3,500 years ago in this country, in the city of Soukhta in Kerman. So these are not a good sign to say that, okay, they are more successful or we are badly, I mean, behind the...
The thing is, Hachi, I think just so we don't drift off the topic, I mean, we have no issue with the West
yes.
or anybody.
No.
Like, for example, developing things...
No, answer the questions here.
For the human being.
Let's not be entrapped by, side questions. Let's
yeah.
go to the...
This is my question,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was saying, anyone... So, if, for example, if the West advances, for example, medicine, where's the harm in that? Actually, on the contrary, Islam says seek knowledge until the from the cradle to the grave.
Okay.
So we, as a human beings, we've been told to seek advances. But when it comes to humanitarian studies, that's a different field because this usually deals with the mind and with the soul. And that's what they got it wrong.
Look, the question is, why they, by their, I mean, unique look at the human being as, for example, one aspect of him, that is a material aspect of human. Why are they that successful? And we as Muslims, for example, looking at both sides of human, we are not that successful. I'm telling, I'm answering the brother. So this, what is the criteria of being successful? He says that, for example, they are really successful, I don't know, in different aspects of sciences and knowledges.
So it's a matter of comparison. Why the Muslim world is not successful? Why the Western is successful?
This is the question.
If that's the question.
So your answer was not that related to the topic.
Yeah. All right. So I think why Islam is not successful, it's got nothing to do with the Muslim, because we as Muslims at the Golden Age, which now they call the Dark Ages, if you go to the universities in the West, they refer to Islam as the Middle Age or the Dark Age, where in fact it should be called the Golden Age, because most of the advances, most of the discoveries, most of the things that we have today, they stem back from, like I said, you mentioned Ibn
Haytham.
We wouldn't have the cameras today if it wasn't for Ibn Haytham.
Yeah, optics.
You are not about optics. To enter the same boat.
Yeah, so that's what I'm trying to say to you. So I'm agreeing with you here. I'm not going against it. So we're saying we're not successful because the West, they tried their best to make sure that the Muslims are not successful.
And to make the best out of the Islamic resources.
Yeah,
you know,
so what they did is that they gave us their culture, which is a very corrupt culture. They said, you know what, guys, go to McDonald's, we'll give you McDonald's, we'll give you KFC, we'll give you Hungry Jack's, we'll give you TV shows, we'll give you Netflix, we'll give you all these things. You guys stay busy while we do the work.
And then
you have to come to us and we'll tell you back what we discovered.
I don't know if you have seen the book Al-Awa'il. It is written by an Arab author that he collected the stem and the root of all the sciences in the world. Yes. This person have done a great job.
Mm-hmm.
That's very interesting that
That's
he said the root and the, let's say, discoverer of every aspect of science and knowledge in the world were Muslims. I mean,
sometimes the picture.
Now, when, as the if at the Dark Ages, for example, they deprive Muslims from their own sources and they actually colonize them, so this is the natural outcome of it.
This
to
is
say that. So this is not not a progress. This is, I think, is a regress. Yeah. Regression than a progress.
Of course.
This is what Professor Edward Said in his outstanding work, Orientalism, has discussed. The picture that the West made out of the Arabs, you know, and the Islamic lands, you know, the man of the sword, and this, you know, the womanizers, you know, and the pictures have been believed somehow by the Arab countries themselves, and they, the overconfidence that they had over the Western world in order to progress and different and develop in different fields of studies, you know, have been a trend among them, forgetting the precious treasures of the knowledge and the studies that they have in the 7th and the 8th century, for example, in the Darul Hikmah of Baghdad, or, you know, in Gundishapur, in Ahwaz University, you know.
So even now, if the West moves its hand from the Muslim world, I guarantee you're going to give so much back to the world. Yep. Now, I don't know, in Iraq this was happening, in Iran it's happening, in other countries it's happening. Mm. Whenever there's an outstanding scientist, he gets assassinated, he gets killed.
Yeah.
Now, how am I supposed to succeed when all my scientists have been killed? Look, I remember in Iraq, time of Saddam, we had so much amazing people that came with amazing inventions, and Saddam had to kill them all.
Yeah.
And when the Americans came, the first thing they did, through when they invaded Iraq in the Gulf War, in the 2003 when they invaded Iraq, the first thing they did, they had a long list of scientists. They killed them all.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do you expect any of the Muslim world to succeed when you guys are killing our scientists?
That's right.
Because you won't accept it, you know?
Okay.
So.
That's right. Okay. This is really a major question of how long should we keep consuming others' production in science, you know? This is a major question, you know? If at least Muslims believe in the famous tradition that acquire knowledge from cradle to grave, okay, they have to go on, they have to continue the studies. Of course, acquiring science from the others, we do not oppose that, but I think
we
that
we create our own.
Yeah, we have to create our own based on our own system of values, and in this way, I think we are not the mere imitators of the other's knowledge and the humanities and the other world. Inshallah. Thank you much, Brother Ali and Sayyid Abdullah, for your presence in the program. Viewpoints, and thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com for the session Call of Islam page. Also, a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanullah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I, when I have you, to doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I'm known, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
The U.S. government is begging the British High Court to allow Julian Assange to be extradited to the United States. Doing so would be a human rights disaster, given that American prisons violate the most basic human rights of political prisoners like Assange. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Chip Gibbons, writer. This article is published under the heading, Julian Assange's extradition to the United States would result in serious human rights violations. Stay tuned for more. For 2 days, British prosecutors, acting on behalf of their U.S. counterparts, urged the U.K. High Court to overturn a judge's decision blocking Julian Assange's extradition to the United States. Although the United States indictment against Assange is a textbook example of a political offense which are traditionally immune from extradition, the judge rejected Assange's press freedom claims. Instead, she found that given the conditions of U.S. prisons and Assange's mental state, his extradition would place the journalist at risk of suicide. In seeking to rebut this ruling, the U.S. and U.K. prosecutor's sadism was on full display. British prosecutors engaged in character assassination of an eminent psychiatrist who they themselves have used as an expert and implied Assange could not be suicidal or severely mentally ill as he regularly watched television in the afternoon. The proceedings also turned on the validity of U.S. assurances that Assange would receive humane treatment in U.S. prisons. Not only are these assurances filed with troubling holes, but even the highest standard of treatment, as outlined by the United States for Assange, would likely amount to torture. This is hardly surprising, given how the United States has treated whistleblowers and others accused of giving information to the media in prison. Given the United States' miserable track record in treating political prisoners like Assange, and prisoners more generally, it's clear that a successful extradition of Assange to the United States would result in grievous violations of human rights. Much of the United States' assurances deal with the potential for Assange to be subject to special administrative measures, that is, SAMS, or be placed in the administrative maximum facility in Florence, Colorado, that is, ADX Florence, a supermax prison, two prospects that alarmed a UK district judge so much that she blocked extradition. The Center for Constitutional Rights has described SAMS as the darkest corner of the U.S. federal prison system, combining the brutality and isolation of maximum security units with additional restrictions that deny individuals almost any connection to the human world. SAMs include both physical and social isolation. Prisoners subjected to SAMs are already in solitary confinement. SAMs forbid prisoners from communicating at all with other prisoners. Only approved family members and lawyers may speak to someone under a SAM, and these calls are monitored by the FBI. A successful extradition of Assange to the United States would result in grievous violations of the human rights. The SAMs apply not only to the prisoner, but impose gag orders on those that are approved to speak with them, including lawyers. Prisoners subject to SAMs are restricted in what information they can receive from the outside world, with prison officials being allowed to censor periodicals about current events. SAMs are reserved for national security and terrorism cases. Assange has stated he thinks he may be subject to them. Joshua Scott, the accused source for WikiLeaks Vault 7 revelations, has been subject to SAM since October 2018. Scott maintains he's not the Vault 7 source and told officials that whoever was should be executed. In March 2020, a jury failed to reach a verdict on the Espionage Act charges against him. The government is seeking to retry Scott, and he remains in jail, subject to SAMs, in solitary confinement, and not allowed to go outside after over 3 years. The United States has not guaranteed Assange will not be subject to SAMs. Instead, they have assured that Assange would only be subject to SAMs if, after he was extradited to the United States, he committed an action that warranted imposing them. This is hardly reassuring. The discretion to impose SAMs rests with the Attorney General, and the way Attorneys General have imposed SAMs is arbitrary, without any due process. SAMs cut off not only defendants, but their attorneys from communicating with the media, a long-time goal of the United States and others when it comes to Assange. Thank you. in blocking extradition, the district judge decided that if convicted, Assange would likely be sent to ADX Florence. In this prison, inmates are confined to their cells for 23 hours a day. In the 8-by-12-foot cells, everything, including the furniture, is made of concrete. Like with the SAMs, the United States has offered assurances about ADX Florence that are full of holes. The United States assures Assange would not be held there unless after entry of this assurance, Assange was to commit any future act that then meant he met the test for such designation. While the assurances are hardly reassuring, what is equally troubling is Assange's fate, even if the assurances are kept. In a declaration to British courts, Assistant U.S. Attorney Gordon Kronberg asserted that if Assange is brought to the United States and subjected to pretrial detention, he will most likely be held at the William G. Trousdale Alexandria Adult Detention Center in Alexandria, Virginia. Kronberg claimed there is no solitary confinement at the Alexandria Detention Center before he described in detail the jail's protective custody and administrative segregation housing units. Inmates in protective custody are not allowed to interact with other inmates. Inmates in administrative segregation, according to Kronberg declaration, are kept in their cells 22 hours a day. British prosecutors rejected the claims that holding a person by themselves in a cell for 22 hours a day constituted solitary confinement. To make this point, they drew on Kronberg's statements that inmates in administrative segregation are able to speak to one other through the doors and windows of their cells, and that inmates in administrative segregation can meet with lawyers. The United States claims, as parroted by British prosecutors, that Assange would not face solitary confinement are patently absurd. The United Nations Standard Minimum Rules for the Treatment of Prisoners define solitary confinement as 22 hours or more a day without meaningful human contact. Under the Mandela Rule, solitary confinement in excess of 15 consecutive days constitutes prolonged solitary confinement. Two successive UN special rapporteurs on torture have stressed that prolonged solitary confinement violates international human rights law and can very likely amount to torture. This is especially the case when inflicted on prisoners like Assange with pre-existing mental health problems. The United States' own description of administrative segregation offered to the UK government meets the standard for solitary confinement under international law, given that Assange is almost certainly likely to spend more than 15 days in jail awaiting trial. Assange's treatment under the United States' own assurances would constitute torture under international law. And Assange would not be the first person charged under the Espionage Act to be held in Alexandria Detention Center, meaning we already have a glimpse at the cruelties that await him. At least three whistleblowers have been held at Alexandria Detention Center. It is where Chelsea Manning was held when she refused to testify before the WikiLeaks grand jury. Similar to Kronberg's declaration, Manning's jailers claim she was not in solitary confinement, which does exist at their facility, but administrative segregation. Manning was kept alone in her cell for over 22 hours a day and was only allowed to leave between the hours of 1 a.m. and 3 a.m. Although Manning was removed from solitary after public pressure, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture still found the U.S. government had tortured her. This was the second time a UN Special Rapporteur on Torture had made such a finding. In 2012, when Chelsea Manning was court-martialed for giving WikiLeaks the documents at the heart of the Assange indictment, her pretrial detention in a military jail was found to be constituted cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment and torture. CIA whistleblower Jeffrey Sterling described his own time at the Alexandria Detention Center in harrowing detail. Sterling recalled being placed in a holding cell with numerous other detainees. We were packed in like so much garbage, sleeping on the floor, and having to use an open toilet before being moved to a special cell block that also housed Zacharias Mussini, convicted of involvement in 9/11 attacks. According to Sterling, his time in this unit was in solitary confinement, and he would spend days on end without being let out of cell. Drone whistleblower Daniel Hale was also recently imprisoned at the Alexandria Detention Center. After pleading guilty to one account of violating the Espionage Act, Hale was initially released on his own recognizance. But after a Trappist reported Hale as suicidal, Hale was ordered taken into custody, allegedly for his own mental health. Such a move is perverse on numerous levels. As Hale's attorney Jesslyn Raddick told Jacobin, Daniel's initial time at the Alexandria Detention Center was tantamount to torture. After being sentenced, a judge recommended Hale be sent to a federal medical facility. First, Hale was transferred to Northern Neck Regional Jail, where he was housed in a room with 100 other inmates. When he was placed in federal custody, Hale was sent to the United States Penitentiary Marion in a communications management unit, that is CMU.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.